Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes.
Live from the Forbidden Book Group studio in Templetown, USA, it's Necronomipod with your hosts, Mike Stuffel and Mike Moncada. Episode 55, Drizzy Kaczynski's The Painted Bird, the story of a young boy in the magical fairyland of war-torn Eastern Europe. And now, a Necronomipod!
Specific military orders are subject to summary execution. Stay in your homes. Repeat, Comrade Channel. This is a Class 1 emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways.
Yeah, okay, now we're beginning.
Okay.
Hey. So we've been on a break.
Kinda, yeah.
Yeah, a little
bit. We just extended from our last podcast to...
Yeah, I mean, it may not seem like that to listener land, but we've been on a break.
Because we posted in August, and we'll be posting in September,
yes.
Hopefully.
Yep, we did. So, but...
we only promise once a month.
Yeah, well,
we don't promise anything. It's true.
I think we've been doing remarkably
what's
well.
What's our unwritten contract with our listener?
Our listener. So how have you been?
Good.
Summer's gone. So what you been up to?
Oh, this and that.
This and
stuff.
That stuff. Been reading anything good besides, you know?
Yeah, I read, wait. Yeah. Yes, I read The Painted Bird by Jerzy Kaczynski.
Really? So yeah. Did I. You know, we should get together and talk about that.
You really should.
Sometime.
I was reading kind of an interesting series, but now I can't remember what it was about. What the hell was it about?
What that tells me is that by reading it, you were like keeping it on your nightstand.
The Lost Years of Merlin.
Oh.
By T.A. Barrow.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And it's good. Barron.
Yeah, T.A. Barron.
T.A. Barron.
Really?
Yeah, cool. I liked it.
I just read the whole Hunger Games trilogy, and it was a pretty intense week and a half. But, you know, it was really good. Kind of deserving of the hype it's getting. I don't think it probably won't knock Twilight off of the top of tween literature's throne, but it's making a good throw at it. But it's a much more worthy book, a series of books.
So. Oh, I read something adultish, but I can't remember what it was. I read To Kill a Mockingbird, and reread it, and then I've read other things since then, but I. They just don't stick out in my mind.
They don't stick in your mind.
Oh, I know what it was. The Painted Bird by Jerzy Kaczynski.
Oh, yeah. Did that one stick in your mind?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever read it before?
No, never.
Really? All right. Well, let's just get to it, shall we?
Okay.
First question. Is it horror?
We're going to try to answer that now or towards the end.
Let's just put it out there, and I'm sure the answer will come up sooner or later.
Okay.
And I got a feeling that we're going to disagree.
Hmm.
So what do you think?
What did I think of the book?
Yeah.
I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I won't ever need to read it again. I thought it was it was so brutal.
So brutal.
It was so I really, really wonder about it, the brutality of it.
Yeah.
But it is sort of the anti-hero's journey in a way. I mean, doesn't let up.
It doesn't let up.
I'm just thinking of, it's sort of like Oliver Twist or some Dickens book, but
he finds respite of a sort.
But it's like, instead of getting hung by his arms in a room, he just gets punched in the face.
Yeah, he gets punched in the face. I mean, he's left lying in a ditch for a couple of chapters.
Yeah, that's the good stuff. Yeah.
But yeah, in the Painted Bird, it starts off with his parents shipping him off somewhere, and to wait out the war, and it's really bad. It's a bad situation, and you're like, oh my god, and he never has it that good again until the war is over, more or less.
And even then, he's ruined.
Yeah, he's ruined. He's ruined.
He's only like 10.
Yeah, 10. Yeah, at the beginning, he's at 10. It's maybe 12, 13 at the end.
Yeah,
maybe.
Maybe.
But yeah, he's ruined.
It just didn't lit up.
It's pretty brutal. It's pretty brutal.
And I'm not a big torture.
There was some.
I don't really get hard excited by that. You know, it's one of my least. It's one of the things that really disturbs me that I try to steer clear of.
Yeah, in your reading and viewing habits.
Yeah, and that one is.
That one was a little much, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, he gets, he's, yeah, I mean, it never lets up, and he, there are some scenes that you're like, this is about the most horrible thing I've ever heard. And I was listening to it.
I think listening would have been worse.
It was worse. It was worse. You know, I listen as I'm commuting. I'll listen on my lunch break. I'll listen as I'm washing dishes or, you know, exercising, stuff like that. And it really, it took the flavor out of lunch. It made the commute less than enjoyable. And it kind of took the wind out of me when I was exercising.
It wasn't time, like so. A light read that, no, oh, it's going to breeze through this. So.
But it is written, has a lot in common with some classic children's books or young reader books. The book that I kept being reminded of over and over again as I was reading through this is Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah, I mean, it has that feeling, but yeah, it's twisted.
It's so twisted. I mean, Huckleberry Finn, in its day, was pretty twisted. You know, that this homeless boy who has no family to speak of. He's got a drunk father who's dead halfway through the book. He's just all by himself, and he sort of cobbles together his own family with Jim. But he goes from one damn thing to the other, and they're grotesque and ridiculous and sometimes kind of awful.
Right.
But nothing like this.
Yeah, this is this book is very much like that.
Yeah.
Except it's way over, it really. And for some reason, I kept thinking of Tom Jones.
Yes, another sort of a picaresque novel.
Right.
Or Don Quixote, where it's just, you know, it's just one damn thing after another.
Right, like it's turned on its ear.
Uh-huh. But some of the set pieces are so rough. And I'll just go right to the one that was too much. And it was the extended scene of the attack of the Kalmucks.
Oh, on that village.
That was horrible. It was horrible.
It really was.
And it is described in loving detail. And so afterwards, you know,
and it killed a baby.
Yeah, and there's a dead baby.
Yeah.
Which you hate.
Which I hate. Which we have brought up a number of times.
As already discussed, Mike Moncada hates that stuff.
Yeah.
But
cheap.
So that one took the savor out of my lunch burrito. A couple days ago, and so I got back to work, and you know, immediately dove back into my job. Of course, after I looked up the Kalmucks to find out what their history is.
Were they real?
Yeah, they're real. It's a real. They're an ethnic group from they're from like southeastern.
Listen, this shit goes on, or still goes on, like in the Congo and.
Oh yeah,
Darfur.
And, yeah, the rape gangs and the attack on the Tutsi by the Hutus during Rwanda's ethnic strife was this bad.
Yeah.
But my immediate reaction, as was my reaction a couple of times to this, is like, you're embellishing.
You're hoping.
And that accusation has dogged this book. It has dogged it, and it's partially the author's fault, but because
was he embellishing? I mean, it's fiction.
It's fiction, yeah. It's published as a novel,
right? It wasn't his story.
He was not as energetic in disabusing people of that notion as he might have.
Is
been.
Is this like torn in too many pieces? Or,
yeah, it's
a million little.
It's
pieces.
It's a little bit like A Million Little Pieces, but which was published as a memoir, though. And that's a big difference.
And I don't have a problem with an embellished memoir. I don't know why.
I don't either. I mean, and this never was.
Every memoir is embellished.
Exactly. It's just
why they made a big deal. Whatever. That's different.
Because Oprah knighted him. So.
It's just it's the American literalism that's just so.
Yeah.
But regardless, he's saying these things happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wouldn't think they would. They did happen.
Maybe not to him. Exactly. You almost can't. I mean, it's a dangerous thing talking about Holocaust books, is that you can't deny anything that people write about. You can't.
Well, and he's not even a Jew, so it's not really even a Holocaust book.
Jersey? Is he?
No, he's not Jewish.
He's
Christian. In the book, the character's Catholic.
Oh, no, he's just pretending to be Catholic.
I don't think.
They kept calling him a gypsy Jew bastard.
I know, and he wasn't a gypsy or a Jew, because he was dark.
Yeah, he was dark. He had black hair and black eyes.
But he was Catholic.
Really?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I didn't read it that way at all, but you could be right. I couldn't point to a page that proves it. Maybe you just don't know. I mean, yes, he does work for a priest and stuff like that, but he doesn't understand the Catholic Church. He doesn't know. I mean, he's young. He's too young, really, to understand.
That's how I took it. He was just a kid. He wasn't.
Yeah, that could be the case. But
I didn't get the sense that he was Jewish.
Yeah. Well, he was.
Maybe he was. Jerzy Kaczynski a Jew?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But honestly, I'd have to look it up, so I'm not positively sure. But I do know he has
black. Checked.
I do know he has black hair and black eyes. The other thing that dogs this book is Jerzy Kaczynski's later life. He was accused, with good reason, of a little bit of plagiarism, or of having his novels ghostwritten. In fact, that charge dogs this book too, because English is not his first language, and very good resources say that he did not speak or write English well enough to have written this yet. But again, does it matter? Not really. The book is still a real kick in the gut.
whoever wrote it.
But it also suffers from.
But you know what? Now I really need to. I think we need to pause and find out if he was a Jew.
All right, let's do it.
Because I think that colors. I think that changes the book, and that's not how I was thinking of this character.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's check it out.
I thought it was like he was being mislabeled.
Yeah.
We will return. Interlude. Musical interlude. Ding, 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 ding. And the
answer is.
And the Emmy goes to.
Jerzy Kaczynski was Jewish.
But we don't. We still don't know if the main character was or not.
You don't. No, you don't.
Because I thought it was sort of like the British thing where they sent the kids to the country to escape the war.
Yeah.
But
I think he's a painted bird. He is externally identified as an ethnic outsider.
An other. Wherever he is, he's an other.
Wherever he is, he's an other. And he is rejected by his own people. And everybody else, whoever they happen to be.
That scene in the village where they're invaded, that's the worst one for you.
It was among the worst ones. There were other really awful ones.
With the goiter.
There's the girl with the goiter who was that.
The incest, the satanic incest.
The satanic incest where they make her have sex with a goat. After he falls in love with her.
And the brother and the father.
Yeah, I know. Good God.
And the where the guy scoops his the young plowsman's eyes out with a spoon.
That also put me off of another lunch burrito a couple days earlier. And that was awful. I'm like, holy fucking shit. Jesus balls. And then when he finds the guy there the next day, he's like, he's crawled out of the hut and he's like made it to the barn. He's just laying there with his face caked with his own blood. His eyes are gone.
Yeah.
It was pretty unpleasant.
Yeah. It was, oh.
I mean, it was like,
and
it was like
him being hung up in the room, and the dog trying to bite his feet, yep. and then getting punched in the face, and his teeth being knocked out, and
teeth being knocked out
constantly, and, his teeth being knocked out.
Anyway, and the worst, some of the worst parts. I mean, the torture porn stuff, just the really stuff, the stuff that you know that that Eli Roth would put on film, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of, those kind of scenes, are hard enough. But the real heartbreaking part of it was when you see that his soul has actually become pretty horribly and permanently deformed. When
and you don't really even see it till the very end.
Until the very end.
When his parents find him.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I was going to say a little before that, but yeah. When he and the Silent One learn how to switch the train tracks, and out of revenge for him getting beaten up at the village market.
Oh, yeah, they kill him.
A whole train full of people.
Yeah.
And but which does not include the guy who actually beat him up.
Right.
And I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
You've become one of them, but yeah. But when he is with his parents, first of all, he's like, you know,
he's mute.
He doesn't want to move in with his parents. He's seriously has serious problems with that because he has achieved a level of Huck Finn freedom and autonomy. You know, he can he's demonstrated to himself and pretty much anybody that matters that he can survive. Take care of himself.
Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Yeah, more or less. To a point. He's pretty lucky. But he's got to be a mass of scars. He can't have any teeth left.
No teeth left, his knees from being whipped, and his...
Yeah. And his
shoulders are probably dislocated.
Dislocated, or actually, he's totally ripped. Because he's really strong from lifting himself up on those on those bars. But, oh, my God.
I don't even know where to begin with that.
At a certain point, I was just like, really? Another village? What horrors await now? And I was just like, I don't know how much more this I can take.
Well, and what I found happening as I was reading this book was just hating humanity.
Oh, I know.
Just
that happens
absolutely.
That happens to me every first Wednesday in November. I'll just say that.
Why?
Because it's after the first Tuesday in November. Election day.
Oh.
Yeah. Sorry.
I'm already you start thinking myself. About. And then my mind starts going to, okay, the next big, trauma or something that happens to this country and people will devolve into their basis.
Yeah.
Superstitious. Well, we're already there.
We're already pretty darn superstitious. And everybody, I mean, every little.
Yeah, there's an enemy around every corner.
Yeah. I mean, that's the picture that you
Tea
get.
Tea party.
That's the picture that you get. That's the picture you get from mainstream media because that makes the most interesting story.
I know, and it's hard not to
and
go there.
And it's hard not to pay attention to it, and it actually kind of reinforces itself.
And that's what that book did. It was like, ugh.
People are shit.
People are shit.
It's one thing I want to talk about in this book is that that it also is kind of a fairy tale. I mean, it really is a kind of a fairy tale.
It's a grim, Anna Grimm's fairy tale, and I thought that too.
Yeah,
definitely.
A lot of people say that it's like he's walking across this Hieronymus Bosch landscape, and it seems like that. But all the there's all these peasants, and it's really it is not kind, and he has been taken to task pretty seriously, by these families that took care of the actual Kaczynski family, felt very hurt that he would portray them that way because they weren't that way, and they actually
weren't they taking it a little too literally?
Of course they were taking it too literally. They were definitely taking it too literally, they weren't able to read it because it was banned in Poland until mid-80s.
I find myself irritated with those people that took who are pissed off about it.
Well,
like, come on.
Well, yeah, but he could have. I mean, I think it was a savvy media play on his part to not make it absolutely clear that these events, for the most part, did not happen to him or his family. He kind of fudged that. He said, this is based on experiences that I had. You know, I haven't read a biography of the guy except for, you know, the Wikipedia, you know, short, quick, and dirty biography. But there are good ones, and he does have a very interesting life, I am sure. Mm-hmm. And he is not above being highly morally compromised.
But if we took, if we just took this book,
yeah,
on its own and not as a piece of history,
yeah, it is. It is.
I mean, is purely as a piece of fiction using,
yeah, yeah,
a war that we're familiar with and maybe, yeah, a group of people that we're familiar with.
Yeah, exactly. Which is a perfectly legitimate and literary thing to do, and he's very successful at it. I mean, it is a remarkable novel. I would say it is a remarkable horror novel. No different, really, than The Keep, which is also has a Nazi setting.
Well, why did you pick this book?
Because I thought it was a really good example of a novel that is a horror novel, but because of luck or arbitrariness or what editor it happened to reach at a publishing house, or just, you know, the author's cred. It is marketed as high literature,
mm-hmm.
but it's both. Horror novels can be high literature.
Well, I mean, it's like splatterpunk.
It's almost like splatterpunk. It is like reading this book is like watching the movie Hostel. Also takes place in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, it really. Yeah, and never makes me never want to go to Eastern.
Well, Eastern Europe's a very lovely place. it really is.
If you don't cross them.
Yeah, just don't cross them, and don't be an obnoxious American backpacker. Just don't. The other thing that this one of the things that this book made me realize was that you remember Dracula. You've read
who?
You've read it several times. And Dracula, part of the horror of Dracula is that he comes out of this milieu, this exotic, benighted Eastern European world with these ignorant, decadent, drunken peasants.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole book takes place in exactly that same world. It is no different, and it's not fair. It is not fair to portray an entire countryside that way. And people take it that way.
Yes, it would be hard not to.
It would be hard not to during the Nazi time, during the Nazi but that is the kind of fairy tale landscape that Jerzy Kosinski is invoking here.
Right.
And that doesn't, how should I say this? It doesn't serve the purpose of making it seem more real.
I'm going to say what you say more.
By fictionalizing these stories, mm-hmm. by saying this is a novel,
mm-hmm.
That gives people a way to back off, which they do. They not back off, but just to set it aside and put it, instead of putting it in memoir or history, they put it in literature, and that's a safer place to put this book for a lot of people.
Well, but that's what it is.
That's what it is. I mean, it walks the line between the two. I mean, that's where he wants to put it.
But maybe people don't want to put it in as fiction.
Yeah, they don't.
Maybe they prefer to put it as...
Yeah, no, I mean, the book's reputation benefits and suffers from that tension between is it true or is it not?
Okay, so since this is one of the most recent books I read, I would mm-hmm. have to say this is what's occurring to me. To Kill a Mockingbird.
Sure.
It if you think about the book
mm-hmm.
and how it's written,
yeah,
you could actually believe this happened.
Oh yeah.
And in some, if not these specific people actually living
mm-hmm.
that type of person.
Sure.
That kind of story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You could see it happening.
Yeah.
That it probably did happen in some way.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I suppose with this book, it's the same feeling, you know?
Yeah.
This is a book that, yes, could these things have happened? Probably.
Probably.
Probably, yes. Is there somewhere in some place in Eastern Europe somebody's making their daughter screw a goat. I would bet. I would bet.
It might even be happening in this very county of ours.
Most likely in Wisconsin, I'm thinking.
I'm guessing it's probably Wisconsin. I do resent that, but I'm going to let it slide.
Listen, weird things happen in Wisconsin.
They really do. They really do.
But does that... So what does that even matter?
Yeah, I mean, what does it matter? I mean, it's the tension between what do you learn about the real world when you read something fictional?
That people are shit.
I mean, you can learn that from...
That people are going to go to their... When they're afraid, they go to their bases.
They go to their worst places. Yes. Yeah. They go to the worst place. And that's exactly what happens.
Right. And is that true? Yes.
Absolutely.
Does that happen now? Of course. Does it happen to that extreme?
The whole demonization of Islam in America is exactly what this book is about.
Yes.
And does Islam...
The whole know-nothing part, resurgence of the know-nothing party.
This book is also about the demonization of America, the great Satan, in Islamic, extremist Islamic cultures.
Right.
It's exactly the same thing. It has to do with ignorance.
And fear.
It also has to do with the usefulness of fear, what you can make people do. It's about how close we are to being, no matter, you know, I mean, this takes place in the 20th century. It is.
Yeah, how close are we are to being animals?
To being getting fucking medieval on each other all the time.
Which has me, right now, while we're riffing on this, I'm thinking of The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
And the demon keeps making these animal noises.
Yeah.
You know, and basically, you know, basically saying humans are animals.
Yeah. Oh, exactly.
Maybe no different than a cow or a pig.
Yeah. No. The Exorcist is also it's a medieval, even an ancient myth bought into the 20th century, and that's why it's so effective and so horrible. Just like the painted bird is, because you suddenly realize how close to pure,
what's the word? I want to say carnal, but is carnal the right word? No,
just like primeval.
Primeval
fear. Primeval fear of the unknown and the different.
Is primeval jealousy and primeval... Yeah.
Tribalism and...
Right. Xenophobia.
Just horrible, like chest thumping caveman sexism, and it's grim. It's really grim. It was a hard book to read.
I'm thinking of that grim fairy tale, the Juniper Tree, where the mother, the stepmother is jealous, and she chops up the kid and buries him under the tree. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it comes from.
Yeah.
The stories come from this.
It comes exactly
from
out of
this
that world.
Place, from this world.
Yeah, and the even more horrible thing is that folklore scholars have gone back to the Grimm's actual notes. You know that they collected the things, and what the Grimm's did is they didn't soften them. No, the Grimm's actually made them more harsh.
Yeah,
they made them rougher. Than the actual collected tales, which is...
And so why would this guy... Let's say these things happened in some way,
mm-hmm.
but Jerzy Kaczynski harshened them.
Yeah.
Put a spotlight on them, crystallized the edges a little bit more.
Sure.
What was his point for doing that?
I think his point in doing that is the reason that I think this is a horror novel. He wanted to have the maximum visceral effect. He wanted to make your stomach churn. He wanted you to stop for a second and go, I can't believe I'm reading this. I can't believe that this could have happened. And which is one of the reasons that people read horror. They want that feeling.
And he wants to mess with your mind so that you're asking the question, did this really happen or didn't it really happen?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess you're right. I mean, I guess the act of straining your reader's credulity is an interesting way to go about it, because I mean, I'm still wrestling with it.
Right, and that's the point.
And he never made it easier, because of in later life, you know, that there was good reason to think that he was not the most, he did not have the utmost integrity in his work ethic as far as writing would go. He would outsource some of the writing, if you will, or crib writing from other people. And this, you know, he died under this cloud. He actually,
was any of it ever really proven? I mean, you can be accused of a lot of things.
You know, I'm actually pretty hesitant to speak to that. I don't know. I really don't. I know that it's pretty likely that he killed himself in the early 90s under this cloud of these accusations. So it doesn't really resolve itself.
Well, and the suicide doesn't say whether the accusations are true or not.
It really doesn't. It really doesn't. It just tells you something about that, you know, he reached
his limit.
He was done, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he had health problems and all that kind of stuff too. So, but at the same time, you have to, that impulse to pick away at a guy's story like that is rank Holocaust denialism. Which is also kind of evil.
Well, I think that's stretching it, to tell you the truth, because they really? Weren't they were he wasn't saying was if it, was he saying the things in the story actually happened?
He never
right
does.
So if I he had think. Said yes, these things actually happened to me, and mm-hmm. then people picked at him,
yeah,
and then that would be something different.
Yeah, I wish I could remember how exactly,
because we kind of don't want to believe those things
happen. No, you don't. The impulse is that, you know. This is too awful. People aren't like this, but you know, although it's kind of, you get a kind of a charge thinking that, well, maybe they are.
What if they are? Yeah.
But
that's the point of why he wrote it.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, right? Because there's a part of our mind that wants to say, no, that wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
That really wouldn't happen, but maybe it did happen. Then yeah. What? But no, that didn't happen.
Yeah, but
so you're constantly and because we're voyeurs, humans are basically voyeurs.
Mm-hmm.
We're interested in if it happened or not. We like to.
We like to slow down the car crash.
Yes.
Yeah. It's that. Yeah. That's the sick as it may be, and we're nothing if not debased creatures here at Necronomipod. that is part of the pleasure of horror. Of horror, reading horror and watching horror is,
but it's much more for me. It's more pleasurable when it's not
so explicit. No,
when it's not based in something that's real.
Yeah, it's too real.
It's too real.
Yeah,
I'd rather have a vampire.
Yeah, it's all of those things.
A crazy peasant.
Yeah, all the things that happen in this book few or maybe none of them happened to Jerzy Kaczynski himself. Some of them did.
Have they happened to people?
They sure as hell
have
happened.
Absolutely.
And they sure as hell happened to people between the years of 1939 and 1944 in Eastern Europe. Absolutely. Kind of brings me to a point.
Cocktail time.
No. We've talked about this before. How the genre of horror, you know, kind of consolidated in the early 60s, late 60s, early 70s. And now it's kind of going away. It's being turned into fantasy or dark fantasy or things like that. And that's those sections of the book start going
slipstream
away.
Slipstream,
yeah, things like that. This book kind of helped me understand better why that is almost maybe a good thing morally. Because this book is truly horror. It is horrible. It is very difficult to, not very difficult. It is a shocking read through and through. Horrible, horrible things. You just recoil from scene after scene after scene. And part of the reason that you recoil is that, like you just said, that it could happen. And it likely did happen. In maybe not precisely the same ways, but very, but too close. But when you get to vampires or fallen angels or wolfmen, that's really pretty much just fantasy. And which is where a lot of those books are now classified, in fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the genres have kind of sorted themselves out a little bit. This is a little too real, so it's in literature. Angelology is a little too fanciful, so it should
be. So it's in the crap pile.
Yeah, so. Of the... books like The End of Alice by A.M. Holmes that we read a couple years ago now is in literature because all of that could happen. All that does happen. Underage girls get abused and guys go to jail and they're seductive and that's in literature. But
what was Man on the Ceiling? Was that literature?
Man on the Ceiling was sold as fantasy, but it should have been sold as literature. But you know,
that's a memoir too.
Yeah, but
in a way,
sort of. Yeah, sort of. It was
written as
it's probably the most slipstreamy book I've ever read.
Yeah, it was written sort of as a
And Man on the Ceiling is by the Thames, for those of you who haven't actually
episode
whatever it was. By the Stephen Resnick and Melanie Tem.
So yeah.
The well is temporarily dry, and you know what we need to do?
Fill it up with
cocktails?
Cocktail. Yes.
And it's cocktail time. Yeah.
Sehr gut.
Okay. Well, this was a tough one. because, you know, we have to incorporate lots of vague ethnicities.
Right.
So here is our cocktail. It's going to be a martini style. What you want to do is you want to do two shots of Zubrovka buffalo grass or buffalo bison grass vodka.
Now, I hear that was illegal here in the States.
It was illegal here in the States until recently. I first tasted it a couple years ago when a friend of mine went to Krakow. When he came back, you know, like I always do when I go to a foreign country, I come back with an exotic liqueur. And so he came back with a bottle of Zubrovka, and he was pouring out shots, but it was delicious. It has this wonderful sort of vanilla-y flavor, but, you know, there's no vanilla involved. It's just this weird buffalo grass. You can get it in America now, and I'm sure all over the world. So, two shots of that. And then...
You could just drink that on its own.
You could, if you were so disposed. But then you wouldn't be drinking this cocktail that we're making. So then, also in that weird corner of the liquor store, you're going to want to look for this sort of a straw-wrapped bottle called Baron Jaeger. It is a, which means bear hunter.
I knew that.
You did.
Yeah.
It's a honey liqueur, and it's super sweet. So you don't want to use too much. You're only going to use a half a shot of that.
It's been endorsed by Winnie the Pooh.
It has been endorsed by Winnie the Pooh, whose head got stuck in it. Very embarrassing.
And then cut off.
Exactly. And then the third ingredient is general Eastern European, but I kind of associate it with the Czech Republic, this liqueur called Slivovitz, which is kind of a... I guess you want to call it like a plum fire water. In the Czech Republic, a lot of families have their own recipe.
Yeah.
When you meet them, they'll pour you a shot of their own family recipe. And I've actually successfully lit a grill with it. It really, really, that the charcoal really went up. So it's strong. So we'll only use a half a shot of that as well.
Okay.
So two shots.
Does it taste like plum on its own?
It's there's plum in behind it. It's kind of like a grappa, but it's a little harsher than that. it's good. I mean, it's good. There are really good and like sort of more mellow versions, but the homebrew stuff can be a little daunting, mm-hmm. and you could go blind.
Oh,
perfect. But you know what you know, it's probably worth the risk. So, two shots of buffalo grass or bison grass vodka. Zubrovka is the probably the most easily attainable variety. Half a shot of Baron-Jaeger honey liqueur. Half a shot of Slivovitz. Shake it up with ice. Pour it in a martini glass. There is no garnish. And keep it away from fire.
And what are we calling this?
We are calling this Flipping the Painted Bird. Chin chin.
I like to garnish mine with a honeycomb.
Because you're a honeycomb kid.
Yeah.
Sorry. Okay, before we get back into this, I don't think I have too much more, except for the bitterness and acrimony part of the podcast. But why don't we head downstairs and pick the next book?
All right,
here we go. I have some very strong ideas about this.
I know you do. And I have a strong idea too, but then you talked me out of it.
Yeah, I know. Well,
because the more we talked about it, the more I didn't want to read it, especially after reading this book.
Yes.
Read the softer side of horror.
Yeah, well, this is definitely softer. It's more psychological, I think. The book that we're thinking of reading, well, actually, let's talk a little bit about the book that we're not going to read.
Okay. I was kind of pushing for Zombies by Joyce Carol Oates.
Yeah, Zombie. Joyce Carol Oates in the early 90s got fascinated, as most of America and the world did, by the case of Jeffrey Dahmer. And so she turned this into a novel called Zombie, which I'm currently reading. And it is pretty much as unpleasant or intermittently more unpleasant than The Painted Bird was. Anytime he gets that ice pick out and tries to lobotomize one of his lovers... is just and it keeps popping eyeballs. It's no good. It's bad. So that's
why they have junior college.
That's why they have junior college. You know,
technical college.
You got to do it on Recessa Annie a couple times first. Anyway, so in lieu of that, we're going to read this other book. Want to tell them what it is?
It is The Tenant by Roland Toper. It was a movie. That was I remember seeing by that was
directed and starring
by your is in my favorite prepubescent rapist
and Eastern European
as well,
Roman Polanski. Yeah, so Roland Topor.
The movie
was very good, very very trippy. And I'm very curious to read this book because I mean Roland Topor wrote a bunch of other books. Some of Twisted Erotica stuff, and this one was reprinted recently by Millipede Press, and so I picked up a copy and I got intrigued, and so we're gonna read that sucker down.
I'm gonna read it down, baby.
All right,
let's get the hell out of this basement.
I know, way too dank.
Yeah, so anything else about this book that we've been currently reading?
Painted Bird.
Well, I say that because...
Yes.
I asked the question because we do leave out... There are a few characters in this book...
More than a few,
that
yeah.
have some redeeming...
Yes.
...qualities, though they are not full out... They're complicated because they have a little of everything in them. Mm-hmm. These aren't, like, pure...
Yeah.
There aren't pure people in this book, except for maybe the main character, whose name we don't know.
Yeah.
There's still this innocence that gets, you know, eventually, you know, beaten out of him, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's so gradual that you don't really see it until you see the aftermath of some of his actions. You're like, oh my God, there's a whole train in a gully there that, because he was...
I was still kind of thinking that one, that he was more of a follower in that.
Yeah, but he enabled. He really helped it along. He could have stopped it.
Maybe.
I mean, and he was only really remorseful when he went back to the market the next day or the day after.
He was mute.
and saw that the one person that he most wanted to have revenge on was still alive and fine. He was mostly upset because he didn't get his revenge. And all those innocent people died. Or were they innocent? Is anybody really innocent? Who can say? But yes, you were saying there are lots of characters in this book, and some of them are, they're not just faceless, nasty peasants, you know, pounding on this kid. There's, what is it, Olga?
Olga.
Olga, the sort of the healer, the folk healer.
Right. But she sort of rescues him in a way.
She kind
of
does.
Because something's going to happen to him. He's going to get sold back to somebody. And she buys him and takes him home and she teaches him things.
Yeah.
She basically teaches him survival skills in some way.
Yeah, yeah.
And he probably would have stayed with her, but the villagers were so afraid of him, they put him on this...
catfish bladder.
Yeah, which I didn't quite understand. Which is also very fanciful. It's like just floating down the river.
Yeah, and he goes bobbing down the river.
And they're all waving goodbye.
Bye, just like Huck Finn, bobbing down the river.
Get the hell out of our village.
There's also...
The soldier.
That's later on. I'm trying to... some of these names, there's so many names.
Well, there's the woman with the goiter who sort of teaches him about
the ways
sex.
The ways of women.
And
the ways of love.
She's complicated in character, but... He feels he gets some, you know, even
closeness, some comfort.
You know, right, even though he's sort of being abused.
Pretty much, yeah. Is that the one? Is that the woman in the family?
Right.
Yeah, and then he kind of falls in love with her a little bit, or infatuation, and then he's
he's intrigued or whatever.
Yeah, and then he's horrified when
she's screwing a goat.
Yeah, he witnesses her father and brother. And a goat and her all doing
Satan
awful things.
And there's this priest who tries to help him, but doesn't really take it all the way.
Yeah, doesn't really take it all the way, and then he's run out of town. After, first of all, he's put into an overfull latrine, a pit toilet. Well, our hero.
Yeah.
And he escapes from there, and he's covered in
shit.
Awful scene. And then one of the last ones you already mentioned, the soldier, Mitka. Well, there's Mitka and there's another one. Is Mitka the hero, the sniper?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's another one who teaches him about the Communist Party and about the greatness of Lenin and Stalin.
Well, that's
Stalin.
The same.
No, there's two Russian soldiers. There's one who's sort of the hero, and there's another one who sort of teaches him about the party and about, you know, the workers' movement and stuff like that.
Right. And the sniper, you know, kills people.
Yeah, yeah.
And takes them and shows them this, but
yeah,
you know, so he's
yeah, and those, and those, and
they're problematic, but
yeah,
and he promises to come back and find him.
Yeah, if his parents don't show up.
Yeah, there's some kindness there, and
yeah,
he rescues him from after this town is.
Annihilated by the Kalmucks.
The Russians come and sort of save the day, and so there's and take him to the hospital and stuff. So there's some.
Yep, yep.
And I suppose the Silent One, the same, is also another character
who's very
complicated, but also shows him some.
Yeah, I mean
kindness and humanity too. Yeah.
But within the
world of this, I mean. That the main character participates in this train derailment,
yeah,
within the realm of this world that he's in.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Oh, I know. I mean, it's basically like you see this kid. I mean, getting abused time after time after time, and then finally you're just like, man, I want this kid to get some freaking payback. And so Jerzy Kosinski gives it to you, and the payback is so indiscriminate, just like wiping out, you know, all of the Jews in Europe, all the dark-eyed gypsy bastards in Europe, completely indiscriminate, and you see the boy get pulled right into it, and the cycle revolves, it goes right around, and now here it comes around again, and it's so, so nihilistic and so despairing.
Here's what I'm wondering is at the end, because I had to reread the end a number of times to kind of understand what was happening, what, because he gets his voice back.
Yes.
But it's not clear why, what's the catalyst to that.
It's weird.
He answers the phone.
He answers the phone.
He hears something on the phone.
He needs to answer.
He needs to answer. We're not really sure what he's been asked or what he's been. And then he has this sort of catharsis of some sort.
Yeah, like the dam breaks or it.
And he starts
speaking.
Speaking in kind of Soviet cliches or something.
Yeah. And that's where the book ends. It's strange. It's, you know,
I think I get it.
Also.
Well, I'm thinking, let's say he's a metaphor.
Okay.
Why was your Eastern European so set up for a Soviet takeover? You know, out of all this brutality, here comes this philosophy or the Soviet ideal that is clean and has straight lines and has
clearly demarcated hierarchies.
Yeah, and a logic and
kind
of has a savior.
Yeah. Oh,
salvific.
Yeah.
Properties to it, and so in the end, you know, when he meets these characters, those last two characters we just discussed, it's these ideals.
Yeah,
right. So after you've been through brutality, you're starving for some sort of something to hang your hat on, something to clutch to.
Sure.
And so here it is, the Soviet ideal.
Yeah, I mean, he's absolutely sold. Yeah,
and that's what he starts speaking. Out of all his chaos, out of all the brutality, out of all of it, this is where he speaks, you know? It makes sense to me, because that's... and he's taken by surprise himself, because he's speaking these things and he's hearing himself speak.
Yeah.
And what is he speaking? Or the first things out of his mouth?
Sure.
Are all these things he was taught by the Soviet dude.
Yeah.
And, yeah, why would people want that? Makes total sense.
Yeah, it's a complete opposite of what they had just experienced.
Right.
Yeah.
It feels like civilization out of the... It
feels like civilization. It's like advancing... it's using all the best of 20th century technology and reason to finally overcome medievalism.
Yeah, so that, to me, that's how it makes sense.
Sure.
Sure. Why he ends the book that way.
Yeah. My experience with the end of the book is about a 40-minute narration is the book was its 10th anniversary in 75-76. A new edition came out, and Jerzy Kosinski wrote this long afterword explaining the reception of the book and the attacks against it, that it was a tissue of lies and all this kind of stuff, that that the people that he knew in Eastern Europe weren't like that, and he complained. He says that, you know, this is a novel. This didn't happen to me. I chose the novel form because in the vehicle of fiction, you can express things more effectively, clear. You know, he just gives a bunch of stuff like that. But then, as he is repeatedly attacked over and over again, he actually relates the story of a couple of Eastern European New Yorkers, immigrants, attack him in his home, in his apartment. And,
like, physically attack him.
Yeah, they come
in. Well, there you go.
Yeah, well, they come
they just
in.
Prove their own.
Yeah, exactly. He comes in. He says, you know, Eastern, he goes, this is, you know, I'm not speaking about specific people, you know, I'm not a prejudiced person. But then he spends the rest of the introduction saying, but this is what Eastern Europeans have been like to me ever since then. So he's actually talking out of both sides of his mouth. You know, using reality, you know, things that actually happened to him too. So, you know, he gets all ethnic on his enemies, just like they get on him. It's a little disappointing to read that afterward, because he's not very generous.
Well, are we expecting we're expecting generosity?
No,
are we expecting too much?
Yeah, we're expecting too much. I'm expecting too much, because in the end, then, that afterward, it kind of was very effective to me, because it helped me understand that the ultimate point of the book and the way that Jerzy Kosinski sees it is that this is how people are. This is how they are 1975 in New York City in my really tony apartment just off the park. A couple of guys come up to my apartment and looking for Jerzy Kosinski. And I tell him he's not here, but he'll be back soon. And then he talks to these guys for a while before he finds his revolver and pulls a gun on him and forces him out of his apartment. Or at any rate, that's the story he tells in the afterward.
And whether it was true or not,
I don't know. It's part of his novel. So it would be interesting. It would be interesting. I was curious when I first read this book back, more than a decade ago. I was like, I should read about this guy's life because I kind of want to find out what really happened to him. And his life as a writer is also really interesting because, after he lived his life, and then became a writer to write about his life got even more complicated.
You know what? What was going on in the 60s? Because you think of him, think of Truman Capote.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the line between the author and what's authored became very thin.
Yeah, well,
there was even some of those, I'm thinking of Howell. The beatnik folks.
Sure. Yeah, there's
the beat poets. I mean, the line starts thinning.
it gets pretty thin. There's a lot of those writers were part of the New Journalism movement, like Hunter Thompson and Tom Wolfe, and Truman Capote, where they or even Norman Mailer.
Yeah, that's the other person.
Yeah,
was Norman Mailer
would write these that books that read like novels that but were like real. They were these are nonfiction books, but they're so crafted and wrought. That they're really pretty much novels, and that's how they're read now. They're read as works of literature, but The Right Stuff or The Executioner's Song, In Cold Blood, or
Breakfast at Tiffany's. That's it. Really happened.
It totally happened. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas,
right?
But you were saying like On the Road, which is a Kerouac's thinly disguised account of his travels back and forth between the coasts with Neil Cassidy.
Yeah.
They're trying to transmute this stuff of reality into fiction, but the line gets so thin that you can sell it as memoir, you can sell it as reality.
But even those the author's lives start becoming brought into question in a way that maybe...
Yeah, that's all Hemingway's fault. Fucker.
And they all kind of got weird in the end.
Yeah, they all kind of weirded out.
We all weirded out. Yeah. Capote got weird, Patton weird.
Yeah, well, after after In Cold Blood, he was pretty much done. It was just alcoholism and short stories from then on out.
Yeah. Because he crossed a line. At least that's what the movies. That's what happened in the.
If I know anything from Philip Seymour Hoffman, is that Truman Capote crossed a line. Same thing happened to Kerouac. He actually managed to spit out some more books, but man, he just drank himself straight.
Or Timothy Leary, didn't he write? Not Timothy Leary.
Dennis Leary.
No.
Mrs. O'Leary.
Sorry. Naked Lunch dude.
Oh, William Burroughs.
William Burroughs.
Yeah.
I was thinking of Augustine Burroughs. Even Augustine Burroughs.
Even Augustine Burroughs. William Burroughs, his books are, some of his books are pretty thinly disguised. Some of them are just incoherent. It's just him fucking
I think
around.
It all started with Anais Nin.
Anais Nin? Sure.
I mean, she wrote their journals, but they were fiction.
Yeah.
Fictionalized versions of her life.
Sure. Or it could have started with Thomas De Quincey, Confessions of an English Opium Eater.
Could be.
Yeah. It's, people write about their lives. Confessions of St. Augustine.
Yeah. It could have started back then. Gilgamesh.
Gilgamesh.
Confessions of a Gilgamesh.
This is a pointless discussion.
No, there is a point.
There is a point.
There is a point when the author is reauthoring himself.
Yes.
And the right in that the writer doesn't disappear for that, for his work mm-hmm. to stand on its own. The writer and what's written are mm-hmm. now, they're indistinguishable.
Yes.
Right? That's what I'm talking
yes.
about. Yes. So there is a point to this pointlessness.
Yes. Yes, there is. And there's not, it's not the tell-all candor, the shameless, frank honesty of Going Rogue by Sarah Palin.
And what's that study in literature that looks at, that doesn't, that the author and the author and what's written are...
Irrelevant?
No, not irrelevant. They become relevant. Wasn't there a movement in literature, in the study of literature?
Well, that's what literary studies originally were, when it wasn't a philology, you know, the study of
language.
I always
thought the original study of literature separated the author from the work, and the work well, stood on yeah, its own.
That's what
all of a sudden in the 60s and in that whole philosophy of...
Well, that's what maybe was reacting against that. In the starting in the late 40s to the 60s, there was something called New Criticism, which was an attempt to make the study of literature scientific. So they wanted it not to be history, study of the biography. They wanted it not to be, the study of linguistics. They wanted it to be something, the study of literature. And so they figured out a way to do that, to disregard what the author's life was about, or its time, his times were, her times were, to disregard what the changes of the English language were, and study the work of art in and of itself, which is frankly impossible. So in the reaction to that, there was a lot of different kinds of literary movements, but I can't think of one specifically that was...
Wouldn't the response to that would be for the author inserting him or herself more in what's being written? Like, purposely not distinguishing...
Yeah, absolutely. I never thought of that.
Confession?
I never thought of that, but that movement that I was just telling you about was called the New Criticism, and I'm sure... Jack Kerouac and Truman Capote and Norman Mailer probably drove those people crazy, Clayton.
Well, I'm thinking of the poet Anne Sexton.
Oh yeah,
and her confessional poetry.
Yeah.
It drove people crazy.
Yeah, because it was so forthright.
Yeah,
yeah. It's entirely possible, and all those people were, you know, in various literary departments, literature departments, and stuff like that. So there.
There's your
yeah.
Yeah, you get two CEUs for listening to this.
Yeah.
Literary criticism, postmodern.
Postmodern. Tick them off.
Postmodern. Postmodern.
Now off to your fencing class.
Well, do you got anything else?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't. I'm pretty excited about reading this next book. We'll see if we'll get that one out in October. It'll be our Halloween book.
I do have a recommendation for a movie.
Yeah.
The Road. Totally recommend it.
Really? I read that book. I haven't seen the movie.
I read
yet.
The book and then saw the movie.
Excellent. Well, I've been holding my annual horror movie film festival, and we've seen some winners. Highly recommend the movie Triangle. It looks like a standard ghost ship story, but it is much more. Just last night I saw the movie called Boxer's Omen, an early 80s Hong Kong black magic feature, which was mind-blowing. I'll never see blueberry yogurt the same way again. we're gonna be watching lots of other movies in this thing. I've been doing this since 2001. Mm. Next year will be the 10th anniversary.
Wow, we'll have to have a party.
Yeah, we'll have to have
a poster.
It's always a party. So that's all I got.
That's it. Yeah. So right.
Let's check it off our list of things to do.
Okay.
Painted Bird.
Done.
All right.
So let's. I don't know what to do with this one. Let's gently put it to bed.
Let's sing it a little lullaby. Pull the covers up to its chin.
Give it a little kiss on the forehead.
Turn on its nightlight and close the door, but leave it open just a crack.
Yeah, I'm for that.
All right.
All right.
See ya.
Goodbye.